This is Radio Anguindian. Anguindian Radio for the Fourth World.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is the Angry Indian. Welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We're not hearing too much from what's been going on in the news from the women who actually do news. And yeah, you can go to Fox and you can find one of the bobbleheads that will have something to say, but it's absolutely nothing to say. And we all know right now, if you're conscious and if you've been paying attention to journalism news, that Fox News has won on appeal, because several of their writers and editors refused to lie about a case on Monsanto in Florida, South Florida, I believe, some years back, that they won the right to win the appeal and win back the judgment that they had to pay to these people, because they said that we're not a news service, that we have a right to lie provided that it doesn't do any real social harm. And that there's nothing in the rules that says that, you know, Fox News as a entertainment, quote unquote, agency can't lie about. So, you know, when we hear the women that they bring up to basically totally take us away from what we should be discussing, we have people who are out there doing real work. Now, Jillian York is a Canadian. You are Canadian. Jim.
No, I'm not. I'm American.
You're American. Okay, for some reason, you come across as a Canadian to me. You know, I don't understand that.
I'll take that as a compliment.
You take that as a compliment. All right, my apologies. Jillian C. York, I've been following her on Twitter. We bumped on the Twitterverse, and she does tend to, you know, pick up. I'm not going to identify her as a radical. I identify her as a conscious woman who pays attention to what the hell is happening. And I really, I'm appalled, and for some strange reason, I take it personally that they really do not ask women who do journalism how the hell they feel about how journalism is being portrayed and how it's actually working out, especially in terms of the WikiLeaks scandals and the sexual abuse of women in the United States military, and we can assume with the Canadian military as well, and throughout the NATO sphere. Anywhere they're dealing in a right now in these operation theaters in Muslim countries, you know, there's just so much that's happening with women that is not being discussed. And of course, we have the Coney controversy that's going on. Well, you know, I like to welcome, you know, Jillian C. York, and you can find her work at JillianCYork.com. Welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, we were talking initially because I haven't seen the Coney video yet, but I'm aware of all of the criticism. Well, first I read the pro film material, then the somewhat critical material that was coming out from the African community in the United States and in Africa, and now it turns out to be a flood of negativity. They finally showed the film last night to an audience, I believe, in Uganda, and they threw projectiles at the screen. There was a lot of, you know, anger. There was a lot of yelling. Women have been the first to come out and criticize this film as not just pro-interventionist propaganda, but the fact that, say, women's issues throughout the continent are not being addressed. And as a female journalist, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, you know, so I mean, I think that, you know, this group that did the video, you know, my opinion, having seen the video and having followed a lot of the news around it, is that they were not really terribly in touch with, let's say, what you might call your average Ugandan, and in particular with women. And I think that, you know, a lot of the commentary on this has been defensive of the video. I mean, aside from the criticism, a lot of the commentary that's been defensive has not really asked the questions about, you know, this sort of white savior thing. I've seen some really great writing on that from Teju Cole and from other people who've picked up on what he said. But I think that people from, you know, speaking in favor of the video aren't really questioning, okay, what does it mean when a group of American filmmakers go into a country without necessarily consulting the local populace and without necessarily even getting the facts straight? That was one of the other concerns here, is, you know, why didn't they go to a Ugandan professor, a university professor even, and sort of vet the content of their video? It doesn't seem like they did that. So it's not just about the average person on the street, it's also about the sort of local view of the situation. And so in terms of, you know, being in touch with women, I can't say that I'm an expert on Uganda by any stretch of the imagination, but I do recognize the unique concerns of women in Uganda in this case, in terms of the rapes that have occurred from the LRA as well as from the Ugandan government. And that brings up another concern, which is that presumably Invisible Children, the group that put the Kony 2012 video together, is in favor of working with the Ugandan government. And there are serious concerns about the Ugandan military's treatment of citizens, and in particular of women.
Well, I'm not sure if you're aware, and I don't remember his name because I don't have it in front of me right now, but one of the founders of that organization, Invisible Children, he's being detained.
Yeah, I saw that. It was public drunkenness and I believe sort of lewd behavior in public as well as possible vandalism. You know, I mean, that obvious character flaw, I'm not sure what it says about the video itself. You know, I don't think it necessarily says anything, but it does put this person's character into question, you know, if it weren't already.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I'm hearing different rumors online that this organization is not just a front, that there's, you know, some really dark stuff behind this, and it seems somewhat strange, you know. And we also have what's going on in Uganda as well, the lawsuit that's being levied against an American evangelical who has gone to Uganda, gone to Latvia, has gone to Moldova to push an anti-homosexual agenda.
Yeah, no, that's right. And that was something, too, where, I mean, Uganda has a lot of evangelical Christians, and there are a lot of, I've seen these videos on the internet, and I've heard about them from friends who've been to the country. There are a lot of Ugandans who are pushing that agenda in a political space. But what's really alarming, you know, that's one thing. I mean, their behavior and their point of view certainly concerns me, but it's coming from within the country. What really concerns me here is the idea that you would have Americans going to a foreign country and pushing these extreme right-wing, or really any political causes, but in particular these extreme right-wing political causes in a foreign country. And, you know, I would ask to that, to what end? How does this serve them? How does this serve the local populace, and how does it serve these foreign groups?
Well, as an African who, you know, recognizes traditional African spiritual beliefs, you know, one of the things that I find shocking about this, and I also criticize the African community in the United States that is Christian, goes to church, and listens and follows these preachers who, you know, have basically started to fill their pews with, you know, anti-gay / anti-homosexual propaganda. One of them, the Bishop Eddie Long, turns out to have a homosexual or / bisexual past himself with several men within his own church. And he's been forgiven for this, and it's been, you know, pretty much ignored. It was laughed at, but it was passed on. But one of the things about this that I really want our listeners to understand is, in the traditional practice of Vodun in West Africa, anyway, I can only speak for what I know in terms of West Africa, where my own Gullah Nation gets their spiritual traditions from, that, you know, what we understand as gay or homosexual, or what is understood in the Native American community, is two-spirited people, that, you know, is actually part of the basis of the religion. Now, it doesn't mean that people have to be gay, but the point is that many of the priests and priestesses of the belief do tend to be homosexuals, because their idea is that these people are in two worlds. And I will quickly point in that when the Portuguese came through South America, came through Bolivia, they murdered all of the two-spirited people, all of the gay, the homosexual people, male and female. They did this because they realized that by doing so, they break the circle.
Mm.
And what they were doing was they were trying to erode the society from the inside. So when they did this, they understood, they knew that the Christian lobby that backs the capitalist lobbies, the neoliberal agenda, when they go into Africa, the people who, you know, they don't go to the doctor, they don't necessarily go to the churches. When people have real problems, they go to the spiritual people who tend to live in this space between two worlds. Not all of them are what we would identify as gay. Even then, gay and homosexual are terms that have no meaning outside of the West.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. This actually, you know, this comes back to the whole international advocacy point. If you're pushing an international agenda, you know, how are you doing that? And one of the concerns that I've seen is some of the international rights groups that work on gay or LGBT rights in, let's say, the Arab world. So there's a great book by Joseph Massad, and I can't remember the name of the book, unfortunately, but on the traditional aspects of Arab sexuality. And there's this idea that, you know, that obviously, you know, homosexuality, gayness, these concepts are Western constructs that are being pushed on a local population. And in this case, what Massad is saying is that, you know, there is this sort of historical bisexuality or homosexuality that happens in the Arab world, but it's not in the same vein. It's not on a rights basis. It's just simply on a behavioral basis. And the idea that these international groups come into these countries, be it in that region or elsewhere, and push an agenda that is very Western is sometimes problematic for local populations. And one example of this is that in many of these cases, you have, you know, individuals who live, you know, whatever their lifestyle, who do whatever they do behind closed doors, privately, who are not actually persecuted by their governments, but then international groups that come in and push their particular Western agenda can make things more difficult for individuals living a gay or homosexual lifestyle in their country. So that, you know, that concerns me, and I think it ties back to the Kony 2012 thing. If you're going to work on the agenda of a foreign country, if you're going to fight for a certain issue in a foreign country, you had better be talking to grassroots activists on the ground. You'd better be sure that your advocacy, your activism, is informed by their beliefs and their desires, rather than you coming in and pushing your own agenda. And that's something that I, you know, strive for. I can't say I'm perfect on it, and there are certainly rights that I find to be inalienable. I mean, obviously, I work on freedom of expression, and so I certainly get criticism sometimes when I'm, you know, pushing a freedom of expression agenda for, say, Saudi Arabia. Where a large majority of the population does not respect the agenda that I'm pushing, and I get that. But nonetheless, you know, I think that is a concern. I do my best to work with local groups whenever I'm advocating for that right to make sure that I'm in line with what they're trying to say, especially in terms of their messaging.
What is the state of women's rights right now and mobility in the Arab world?
So one thing that I would say is the quick answer is that, you know, I think a lot of the media paints the Arab world with one color. And so, you know, even pre-revolutionary Tunisia, women in Tunisia have had a lot of rights for a long time. For example, abortion rights, which are still under debate in the U.S., abortion has been a right in Tunisia since the 70s. Then, you know, you look at the opposite extreme, Saudi Arabia, where women still can't drive. And so I would say that for the majority of the countries in the region, women have considerable legal rights, but not always the same social rights. And so in places like Morocco, where women, where polygamy is dependent on the woman's signature for a second wife, but socially, you know, she might be pressured to do so. It's the same thing with, for example, wearing the headscarf, which a lot of women choose to do, especially in the diaspora. But you know, it's only forced upon women by law in Iran and Saudi Arabia, and yet, you know, there are obviously cultural constructs that force it upon women in other countries where it's not required by law. So I guess the long and short answer is that really it depends on the country, but I think that, you know, if you want to look at where women are making great strides, I think Tunisia is the first place to look.
Well, yeah, I just think you brought up an excellent point. The invisible hand, you have the right by law to do what have you, right? Mm-hmm. Now in the case of being a female, whether or not you choose to wear the hijab or not to, or mm-hmm. if you choose to even, say, leave your husband and maintain your half of what you feel is your section of the property. But what is actually happening in daily life for women in, say, Egypt, as opposed to what's happening for women in a Palestinian refugee camp somewhere,
right,
in Lebanon?
Right, no, absolutely, absolutely. And I think that, I don't think that we're always hearing from those women. I mean, I think, like I said, the same thing with them, keep coming back to this point, but, you know, international advocacy groups, when they're fighting for women's rights, sometimes I wonder how often they're consulting local women for how they would like their rights advocated. Because yes, absolutely, I do believe that women in Iran or women in Saudi Arabia should be able to drive, should be able to take off their hijab if that's what they choose. But is that the best way for me to go about fighting for their rights, or would they prefer that we start with something simpler, like access to education in rural areas? And so I think it's really important to ensure that these groups are asking women what they want. And
okay, you're listening to Jillian C. York. She's the Director of International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which I really hope you would check out, EFF.org. And she writes regularly about free expression, politics, and the internet, with a particular focus on the Arab world. She is also on the board of directors for Global Voices Online, which is another resource I would hope our listeners would look at on a regular basis as we do. And she has written for a variety of publications, including Al Jazeera, The Atlantic, The Guardian, Foreign Policy, and Bloomberg.com. This is The Angry Indian. You're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to The Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginals.
Curious or confused, get information or a pamphlet at most pharmacies or a health clinic. If you need help, see a doctor.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power of making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
This is Kristen Hirsch from Throwing Muses, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license.
Aquí de mano la aventura Radio Bemba, toda la familia ahí que estamos en Europa, estamos ahí con Alto Arizona y con vosotros a muerte para todo lo que sea.
Mi vida va prohibida.
Radio Bemba, Manucho, fuerza con vosotros siempre.
Go ahead, ready?
I'm Forrest Whitaker for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and this is my daughter, True.
Hi.
Life is full of choices, and many years ago, I chose to become a vegetarian, and it's one of the best choices I've ever made. And since True's dad was a vegetarian, she decided to be vegetarian, too. You may decide to go vegetarian for better health, for a better environment, or you could be like True and I and just decide you don't want to eat meat anymore.
I love
love animals and I love being a vegetarian.
I'm Forrest Whitaker.
And I'm Drew Whitaker. And we're vegetarians.
For more information, visit PETA.org.
Nicely played. Sachin is off the mark.
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together, become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the 7 generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
Hi, this is Randy Rhodes. You know, when Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held serious bipartisan investigations that did result in articles of impeachment. He resigned before he could be impeached, but strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war, lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court orders, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, tortured, used illegal weapons, and targeted civilians. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
And the Democrats are throwing the election away. For what? An inadequate black male who would not have been running had it not been a white woman that was running for president. I'm no second-class citizen. And goddamn the Democrats.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
This is DJ Fusion of the Fusebox Radio Broadcast and BlackRadiosBack.com. You're now listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, another slice of real black radio for the masses. Alright, peace.
C'était une émission de radio.
Internet radio for smart aboriginals.
Welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. I'm your host, Angry Indian. This is the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, broadcasting to the Aboriginal community from radioforall.net. And we're also blogging this podcast from our Feber and our RSS feed at Fourth World Radio. We are carried by a never-writing network of independent information providers, not financially hamstrung by the corporatist news model. For more information about the news items and opinions discussed on this internet radio broadcast, please visit our electronic newspaper, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. You can also leave us a polite voicemail at Aboriginal Media Group via Google Talk. And you can always email our studios at aboriginalradio@lavabit.com. Hi, welcome back, my brothers and sisters of the Fourth World, our non-Aboriginal ideological comrades, and the negative elements staunchly opposed to human justice and social harmony. But in spite of that, take the time to listen to this show on the sly anyway. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. And we're speaking with Gillian C. York, a journalist out there that, you know, I really feel that you deserve much more attention than you get. We're talking to her about what's not being discussed in media, which is basically the female angle to the majority of these stories that are coming out, be it the Coney story, be it what happened in Libya, well, what's still going on in Libya. Nothing's really changed. I mean, what's happening in Syria? I mean, what's the toll right now for the amount of women who have been either killed, wounded, displaced in Syria right now? What's the story with that?
So I haven't actually seen reports on the specifically the death toll of women. it's been, you know, the dental reporting has been, I don't want to say skewed, and I don't want to say biased, because that's not really what it is. What's happening is that the mainstream media is relying almost entirely on the opposition, and not just the opposition on the ground, but also opposition networks and groups outside the country. And I find this to be a bit problematic for a couple of reasons. One is that they're not always very specific about what they're reporting on and how they're reporting on it. And I've actually written to a couple of these groups to ask for some questions about their methodology and haven't gotten any responses. The other concern, of course, like you said, not any specific reporting on women, presumably all civilians. Women don't serve in Syria's military. And then the third bit is there are not very many reports on the non-civilian death toll. So the thing about Syria is that military service is compulsory. You either do it after high school, or if you go to university, you do it right after university. And, you know, at this point, I think that it would be somewhat unfair to assume that anyone in Syria's military can defect without being killed immediately, right? So we could argue for the principle that they should be defecting, and I certainly would like them to be defecting. But, you know, if you're a 22-year-old member of Syria's military, and Syria does have a quite young population, so you've got a young military. If you're a 22-year-old member of Syria's military, and you fear defection, and you're killed doing your job, why is your death not being reported on? Why is it not being counted? Which, you know, it also says nothing of the general military death toll that is, you know, not so, let's say, innocent for argument's sake.
Yeah, one of the other things I wanted to ask you is the issue of sexual violence against women in the United States military, and then, you know, I believe I mentioned this earlier, to some degree, I believe in all of the NATO forces that have women serving in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and possibly even in Africa at some point. Why is this not being discussed? We're hearing up to a third of the women who are serving in the military, in the Western Alliance, if, you know, for lack of a better term, are being abused.
Yeah. So this is something that I can't claim any sort of level of expertise on, but I would say as a media consumer, you know, the concern that I have here is that, you know, the response to this problem often seems to be to say, okay, well, then women shouldn't serve in the military, or women shouldn't serve in combat situations. That's generally the political response to the problem, where the real problem is the behavior of men towards women in the military, not the fact that women are there.
Yeah, I mean, we're hearing various stories on, I guess, what's supposed to be the left about the Air Force and how it has become the ultra-evangelical, ultra anti, you know, women or anti woman, you know, branch of the military, and that this has sort of seeped into the other branches. That, you know, even with the, when I first started hearing about these cases, it was not with U.S. military personnel, it was with Blackwater personnel, these allegations.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, not an expert here, but this is definitely something that concerns me as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm appalled that this is not being discussed, and that the American media, the American corporatized media, in any case, has been silent on this. The next thing I wanted to ask you about is censorship. You recently did a piece on censorship, and, you know, the censorship, you know, like what we were just talking about, the what women are going through in the military, in the professional military, you know, that is obviously being censored. It's either hard censored or it's being soft censored, but in some case, you know, we're not getting as much information as we need and as we should have to actually live and work in a functional democracy. So, what?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, the hard censorship that happens in Iran, in Syria, in China, that's one thing, right? That's something that is concrete that we can look at and say this is happening. We can technologically test for it. The type of censorship that happens in the U.S. is a bit more insidious, and I wouldn't call it necessarily the traditional definition of censorship, but you do have this sort of shutout of certain voices in the media, and I think, you know, we've talked about Palestinian issues before we started recording, and that's a really great example, right? You don't don't hear a lot of Palestinian voices in the U.S. mainstream media. And let's not even, you know, that's not even saying anything about any particular agenda, be it two state, one state, no state, whatever. The concern is just who's being heard. And so when you see reporting on Palestinian issues, you often see Palestinian Americans being quoted. You see Israelis being quoted. You see Israelis or you see Israelis writing these stories. You also see even the New York Times bureau, based in Jerusalem, with all American writers, no Arab American writers. I've definitely got concerns about the way. I mean, and that's just one example, but the way a lot of these things are portrayed is that what we have is essentially white Americans writing about foreign issues without much input from individuals on the ground. And you know, I mean, I think that there's a flip side to that, which is that a few months ago, an Egyptian friend of mine was complaining to me about a certain Egyptian journalist who gets quoted a lot in the media as representing Egyptians. And while I understood what he was saying, my response to that was kind of like, okay, but you just told me 5 minutes ago that you don't want to talk to the New York Times because you think that their coverage is biased. And so, you know, it's sort of, if you're not going to talk to them, who is? And so there's two sides to the coin. On the one side, the media, the mainstream U.S. media, has historically not done a great job of representing certain voices on the ground, but at the same time, those voices on the ground have become so fed up that they're no longer willing to talk to the mainstream media. So you do have kind of a catch-22 here.
Yeah, you know, it's really getting to the point. I mean, we try to verify what we opine on over here at the Aboriginal News Group through the mainstream media. You know, for the simple fact that if you question what we're saying, this is what the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Guardian, what have you, this is what they're reporting. So, you know, if we're wrong, then they're wrong too. You know, I mean, this happened in cases with things that have happened in the Native community here in the States. Well, we quoted CNN, and people are like, well, you know, you're full of it. Well, then if we're full of it, so CNN.
Sure, sure.
You know, but, you know, the point is that CNN is a corporation, and corporations are people that can do no wrong in the lower 48. You know, so, you know, we're, again, you know, on the issue of censorship, do you feel, as a female journalist, as an independent female journalist, that there are females who are, I'll say, like Amy Goodman, who is being, say, somewhat marginalized, even though she did recently appear on MSNBC, I understand. But, you know, how often do we see, you know, reporters like her, like you, out there in the mainstream media? Is this
true?
A form of
it's
censorship?
Pretty rare, and those who start out maybe offering a feminist voice in the media often end up, and God, I hate to use this word, but co-opted, right? So you've got like Maureen Dowd, who I used to really like, and who now, you know, has said some pretty appalling misogynistic things herself. And so, yeah, I mean, Amy Goodman is a great example, but she, you know, I think she does great work, but by, I don't want to say by choice because I don't know her circumstances, but by choosing to work for what is generally considered in the U.S. a fringe publication, which, don't get me wrong, I really respect her for, but I think that she ends up being marginalized because people don't necessarily take Democracy Now! Seriously. Now, I think they should. I think they do excellent reporting, but that's just, they're not, I don't see them being considered mainstream. But I also think that those women who do choose to write for mainstream publications, you know, are going to get edited down or fired really quickly if they are taking an alternative view. And so it is really difficult, and I think that we need to think up solutions to that. You know, although the other thing is, I would say that in the past few years, particularly owing to social media, I think the general populace is more inclined to view alternative media now. And so this is a great thing because it gets voices like hers heard, you know, at a much higher volume than, say, 10 years ago.
Now, Naomi Wolf came out not too long ago and really had her keister kicked up over her shoulders because she disagreed with the incident that you and I were discussing. Well, it was actually two incidences. The Alobidi case, which many people consider to be a propaganda stunt, because, you know, no one's heard anything about this since then. Which, you know, and I've tried to explain to a lot of people also, you know, that this was done so well because if you question her, then you're in question. And if you question the situation, you're in question. But then at the same time, to not question is questionable. Because, you know, it was just so perfect. And then right around this time, you know, I mean, Naomi Wolf pretty much said what I had said in editorials, that it brought the feminist lobby, for lack of a better term, and it definitely brought the left in to support this woman, rightfully, but people went in without really looking at what the hell was going on. And then we heard about the condoms being, and Viagra being distributed by Gaddafi to his troops. And all of that turned out to be false, because none of the UN observers noticed any of this, and they were directly asked about this by the European press. And they said negative to this. And then we have the Assange case. I mean, how do you think that women may be manipulated by propaganda in what is, I understand, the lingo, I guess, in the intelligence community, honeypot traps?
So this one's hard for me to comment on, because I actually didn't follow the first story as closely as you. And as for the Assange case, you know, that's a difficult one, because we still don't know what really happened in that case. It's a tough call. I mean, I think that, you know, women are no more susceptible to propaganda than men inherently. But at the same time, you know, owing to a power balance, you know, we may be more apt to be pressured by powerful authorities into these circumstances. And so, yeah, I mean, I can't say in either case what the truth is. I just don't know. But, you know, if we're just speculating here, you know, I can certainly see how a woman could easily be coerced by a powerful authority into lying. And again, I'm not saying in either case that women are lying. I don't know.
I mean, you know, yeah, I don't know either, and I'm trying to be as objective as possible, but, you know, being, you know, the way things are, we have the Dominique Strauss-Kahn case, mm-hmm. in the States. The same thing happened. You know, he was supposedly to run for president against Sarkozy, and this was a way to really get him out of the way, you know, and the way he was treated. It was very public. The way he was, you know, lambasted in the press, the photos, and, you know, the whole the circus that was built up around that. And what I tried to point out in some of my editorials is, you know, I'm going to be agnostic about Alobidi and about what happened with DSK, for the simple fact that they're not addressing what's going on in the military to women at all, and what's happening with Blackwater and what have you at all. You know, we don't hear anything about that.
Yeah.
We don't hear anything about that. We don't hear anything about the fact that American activists like Lori Berenson, who got caught up in Peru. I don't know what she was doing in Peru. I have no idea what she was doing in Peru. I just know that she was down there saying that she was, you know, trying to, in a peaceful way, support the indigenous community down there. And the Clinton administration pretty much handed her over to a military court. And they sentenced her to a ton of time, and she's, you know, kind of like semi-released, and she comes out pregnant. How many women go into the system and come out pregnant? We don't hear anything about this. You know, we don't hear anything about the rise in STDs and how this affects the female population. You know, especially for women who have, you know, have to make certain decisions in order to put food on the table. I'll just say. We don't hear anything from this, and we don't hear anything about this, I mean. And, you know, where are the female journalists? Because I know there are women writing about this, because I read their editorials, I read their articles, but why are they not seen in the mainstream media?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know, you know, I can say from my personal perspective, I've certainly, you know, I've had a tough time on my own at times being taken seriously, both in my field as an activist as well as in getting published, and I can't necessarily attribute it to gender. I don't always know what the reason, but I you know, have a sneaking suspicion at times that, due in part to my age, I am somewhat on the young side, due in part to my age and due in part to my gender, I'm not often taken seriously despite, you know, expertise on this or that subject. And it's incredibly frustrating. And I don't know how we can appeal to the powers that be in the mainstream media.
Well, I say we move around them. You know, we continue to do what we're doing right now. You know, we're publishing this and we're sending it out, and hopefully people will listen to it, and you know, people will visit your site and see what the hell is going on. Okay, Jillian C. York, thank you very much for being
a
guest.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you know, I really want everybody to check her out. I've been following her for quite a while. You know, she's got a good sense of humor. And I really think that she really looks at issues, you know, from, and maybe this is because I'm a Native man, but, you know, we need to listen to our sisters. They see things that we do not see. And as males, we need to accept the fact that they will see things that we will not see. You know, it doesn't mean that we're weak because we allow our women to show us what is out there, what is invisible to us. That makes us stronger. That is being a complete human being. And whether it's being, you know, news or how you run your own home, you have to make the circle complete. So this is The Angry Indian. You've been listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, speaking to Jillian C. York, and I'd like you to visit her site at JillianCYork.com. Peace to you all, and, you know, just try to bring it all together, man, because, you know, this is The Angry Indian. Peace.
Teach to me. Try to teach me and tell me. You know, some guy, some pirate that found out later, 18,000 miles off his course, discovered America. Ask questions about that. No teacher could ever answer. So that's how this movement came about. And we knew we had to change the name, the acronym, Concerned Indian American Coalition. That's CIA. So we put out the word to the people. We didn't want, Clyde Belford didn't name it, Dennis Banks didn't name it, the American movement. We wanted people to name this new organization. 3 weeks later, two elderly women came in. The dog would be like a cock. I went outside with them. They said, why don't you call your organization AIM? Why? Are you aiming to do something about police brutality? Are you aiming to do something about rulership and justice? Are you aiming to do something about the foster care system? You know? You're aiming to do all... Well, what does it mean? She said, American Indian Movement. Oh, I said, oh, no. We're not going to call ourselves Indians anymore because some pirate was 18,000 miles off his course. That elderly woman grabbed me by the shirt. She said, listen here, sonny. Indian is what they use to oppress us, and Indian is what we'll use to gain our freedom. I said, okay. Go. That's how we got our name. That's how this movement came about. One of the most powerful movements to ever exist here in the Western Hemisphere and perhaps the world.
Hello, this is Maurice Muhammad, Minister of Information with Black Unity, and you can always find us at www.blackunity.name.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Internet radio for smarter than the original.